When I agreed this week to speak, I just assumed it would be on the lectionary. Imagine my surprise when I looked at the readings. So this is, as Jenna says, the third in our series on focus on the dysfunctional family. About one-fourth of the book of Genesis is devoted to the story of Jacob. So he's a central character. Eventually his name will be Israel, and the descendants will take that name, which they rather prefer to his present name. A number of characters are interesting in this, and I hope that every one of you has the sheet with the scriptures, because I'm going to be following it very closely. So if you need a sheet, I don't know if there are any extras or
lots,
yeah. One of the characters that we meet in verse 15 is Laban, but I'll back up for those of you who haven't heard the series and haven't read Genesis lately. Jacob had just deceived his father, had pretended to be Esau, his older twin brother, and did that so that he could get his father's blessing. He succeeded, and his brother Esau decided he's going to murder the guy after his father dies. So Jacob's mother, who's behind all of this, convinces Jacob's father, that Jacob should flee and go to another part of the country, over to Haran, to get a wife rather than marrying any of the local hussies, and decides that that would both preserve his life by fleeing his brother's wrath, and he would marry within the family, within the faith. So he goes and encounters God, as we heard in the talk last Sunday by Vange, and has this dream, this vision of angels ascending up to heaven and descending, and the promise that God will be with him. And this is a transforming moment in Jacob's life. Now he encounters Laban. Laban is Abraham's great nephew. He is an Aramean, meaning that he speaks Aramaic. Being in Haran, their marriage customs are going to be a little different than those in Palestine, and this will come up in the story. And Laban apparently worships both God and other gods. Laban is the kind of guy who covers the bases. So later on, his daughter Rachel is going to steal Laban's household gods and sit on them while she's claiming at least to the ways of the woman are upon her, menstruating. And the Jewish commentators love that because that's making the idols impure. Laban had helped arrange the marriage of his sister Rebecca to Isaac, and so Laban knows the family well. And now Jacob has encountered Rebecca at the well, fallen in love with her instantly. Love at first sight, one of the first instances of this recorded in the Bible. And this brings us to our story today, verse 15. Then Laban said to Jacob, "Because you are my kinsman, should you therefore serve me for nothing?" Because he'd been working for him for a month. "Tell me, what shall your wages be?" Well, unlike Abraham and Isaac, Jacob fell in love with the woman he wanted to marry and fell in love with her immediately. The others, we don't hear of them loving their wife until after their wives give them sons. And then it's said that there was love there. Jacob, in verse 16, well, the story goes on. Now Laban had two daughters. The name of the elder was Leah, which means cow. This is very much a rural society. The names in Genesis are just mind-boggling. And the younger was Rachel, which means ewe, as in a sheep. Leah's eyes were lovely, and Rachel was graceful and beautiful. Jacob loved Rachel. So he proposed, "I will serve you 7 years for your younger daughter, Rachel." Now, verse 17 about the eyes, there's a lot of controversy there. Translations disagree. Some say the Jerusalem Bible takes an extreme stance. It says there was no sparkle in Leah's eyes. Others say that her eyes were tender or loving or weak. Everyone's agreed that the eyes are trying to get at the personality, and they're trying to differentiate between the personality of Leah and the personality of Rachel. Rachel is apparently not only a looker in modern, well, what I call modern terms, but I don't know what people say now, but had sort of a lively, aggressive kind of personality that would be a lot of fun, whether she was out in the field tending sheep or with the other lads or just doing things. Whereas Leah seems to be more inward looking and not obviously so sprightly and whatnot. We're reading an awful lot into that one word. But the word seems to be best translated as tender and possibly quietly loving. Jacob suggests that he will serve for 7 years for this. And so Laban says in verse 19, "It is better that I give her to you than that I should give her to any other man." Hardly a compliment. "Stay with me." So Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed but a few days to him. Laban, in verse 19, seems to agree with the philosophy of his sister Rebecca. It probably is better to have your children marry similar people, possibly even people within the faith, than it is to marry people with very, very different customs and possibly outside the faith. I hesitate on this because there's some discrepancy in my mind between the faith held by Isaac and his family and the faith practiced by Laban. But there are similarities too. As for dating 7 years, it's a long time to date. Janice and I dated for 5 years, seven out of the question. Perhaps Rachel was still quite young, not able to bear children, and so it was worth waiting. I don't know. Perhaps Jacob knew that the oldest daughter was to be married off first, and he thought even Leah could get a husband in 7 years, and then he'd be free of her. But I'm reading things in. Nobody knows. It's tantalizing how he came up with this 70 years. Typically, apparently, what happened is that the husband was, the groom was supposed to pay a fee or give a dowry of some kind to the bride's family. And some records say that in this area, in nomadic society, it was not typical to give 30 to 40 shekels of silver. A shepherd could earn about 10 shekels of silver a year, and so 4 years of service would have done it. Jacob, in his enthusiasm for this beautiful daughter, decides 7 years will certainly do it and win him over, and he's right. Also, Jacob is head over heels in love. He is, in a sense, defenseless because none of his immediate family is there to help him out. And had he not deceived his father, he would not have had to flee without any of his father's wealth. He could have purchased her, money on the barrel head, no problem. But because of his deceit, he had to flee, and now he's going to pay the consequences financially. The 7 years is also going to give him time to reflect on life, on the vision that he had had, on many, many things. Verse 21, "Then Jacob said to Laban, 'Give me my wife.'" Now notice he doesn't ask directly for Rachel. This is a loophole. "Give me my wife that I may go into her, for my time is completed." So Laban gathered together all the people of the place and made a feast. So it's payday, unlike any other payday I've ever had. Laban calls the other Bedouins together for the festivities. It's going to be a remarkable wedding feast indeed. But surely some attending the feast suspected what was going to happen. Or they must have wondered, is Laban going to break tradition? What is going to happen here? Verse 23, and this stuff should be a movie, folks. But in the evening, he took his daughter Leah and brought her to Jacob. And Jacob went into her. Laban gave his maid, Zilpah, to his daughter Leah to be her maid. And when the morning came, oopsie, wrong girl. Okay, verse 23. Uncle Laban is truly Rebekah's brother. Rebekah had orchestrated deceit without any problem at all against her husband. And now Uncle Laban, her brother, is quite willing to practice deceit as well. Now Jacob, the deceiver, is deceived in turn. Reminds me of a saying of Jesus, those who take up the sword will die by the sword. Those who practice deceit regularly, they're going to get it right back, we hope. Jacob had masqueraded as his brother Esau. Now Leah masquerades as her sister Rachel. Jacob had deprived his father when his father could not see. And now Jacob is deceived when he could not see because of darkness or because of the cover of the veils. Jacob wanted to be, who was the youngest, wanted to be the oldest. And now when he wants to marry the youngest, he gets the oldest. But give a thought for poor Leah. Unmarried for 7 long years, she likely had no say whatsoever in the deceit. What a horrific wedding night to know that your husband thinks he is loving someone other than you. This cannot be a good start. In verse 24, when Leah is given her own maid, Leah thereby gains prestige, her own personal household or entourage, her own helper. And eventually, I think the reason this lady is named is because this maid or this slave will be given to Jacob to sleep with so that she could have more children through her surrogate wife. Verse 25, continuing. And Jacob said to Laban, and the Bible sometimes does sanitize conversations, what have you done to me? Uncle Laban, shame on you. Yeah. 26, Laban said, this is not done in our country, giving the younger before the firstborn. This seems to be true enough, depending on which commentator you read. And the delightful thing about Genesis is you can come to it with any preconceived notions you have and find a commentary that will buttress your opinion. This is just a great book to say. Or on the other hand, you end up with such divergent opinions that you just shake your head and say, well, this seems to be the majority. I'll go with the flow. The flow seems to suggest that, yes, indeed, an unmarried daughter in a nomadic society would be something a family would try to avoid at all costs, because in her old age, she would not have the protection of children of other males in the clan. That kind of support was apparently quite important if she was going to have any quality of life that was worthy of her family's dignity. Therefore, you don't want to marry off only select daughters and have the others be cut loose financially. The daughters were used by families to gain wealth for the families, and it was assumed that men could make it as workers in the field on their own. It was also assumed men could marry, regardless of how homely or ugly they were. I would be a case in point. And so this custom was surely known to Jacob. But Jacob is someone who flaunts custom. And now he is being paid back. And one of the points of the story seems to be you cannot go through life flaunting society's customs all the time and all the time get away with it. Jacob had flaunted the custom of the eldest son getting the best blessing. And he used all sorts of deceit and lies and even invoked God's name to achieve that blessing. Jacob flaunted the custom of the shepherds in that part of the country who wanted to divide the well water equally once a day, all together at the same time, in order to protect the water supply. They wanted to cooperate rather than compete, and Jacob went against that custom. And even when he asked for Rachel's hand and waited for 7 years to marry her, could it be that he was unaware of this custom of the elder daughter being married first? We don't know. But I think he must have learned about it. So my interpretation is that Jacob enters into the marriage festivities knowing that he is flaunting custom. Not law, not moral law, but the way things are done. Verse 27, Laban says, "Complete the week of this one," meaning of this marriage of Leah, "and we will give you the other daughter, also in return for serving me another 7 years." Uncle Laban knows he's on to something. Jacob had already slept with Leah one night, and so he's now going to complete the bridal week. Husbands apparently were given a week off work so that either the wedding festivities could go on for a week or they could at least be at home with the bride for a week. And the purpose is obviously to get the show on the road, to impregnate. And then you know that the offspring is the groom's offspring. We have honeymoons now, so it's a very, very ancient custom, although with birth control for a different reason. Jacob is essentially supposed to be bonding with Leah as his wife before turning to the woman he loved. And he's recorded as loving Rachel a number of times in Scripture. It's never recorded that he loved Leah. Verse 28, Jacob did so and completed her week. And then Laban gave him his daughter Rachel as wife. Laban gave his maid Bilhah to his daughter Rachel to be her maid. So Jacob went into Rachel also, and he loved Rachel more than Leah. He served Laban for another 7 years. So in verse 28, there's no mention of a second marriage celebration for the beautiful but now unfortunate Rachel. One can hardly imagine Rachel's feelings at this point, waiting for a week while her sister sleeps with her husband-to-be. Of course, we don't know if Rachel loved Jacob. We only know that he loved her. I'm assuming it was mutual, but we don't know. I say this because at another point in the story later on, both women say to Jacob, when he asks, "Could we flee Laban and just take off? It's getting too hard here." They say, "Yes, our father has sold us. We are now foreigners to him." That this is very much a dysfunctional family kind of imagery, not the loving grandparent image that I would cherish for the story. Two wives, one loved more than the other. This is a very sad start for the new family. two sisters married to the same person. This is going to be prohibited, finally, in Leviticus 18:18. Not that I know Leviticus, believe me, there are footnotes. The two sisters are going to compete for Jacob's affection for the rest of their lives, even giving their handmaidens, their slaves, as surrogate wives, in order to beget more sons. And they are clearly keeping score. It's a competition from the marriage onward. This family division will be carried forward by the sisters' sons. Some of Leah's sons will eventually sell Rachel's son into slavery. One wonders whether polygamy must always have this sort of horrific competition. Verse 31, when the Lord saw that Leah was unloved, he opened her womb, but Rachel was barren. The story could hardly have a more sad conclusion. Now comments. Probably have another prayer at this point. Just random comments, and I'm looking forward to what comes from your reflection on this story and on Genesis and the series we've had. It seems to me that the phrase, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, should be the God in spite of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God did not depend completely on people being the best that humanity has to offer. It's very clear that these are frail men, men with very real human problems, families with very real problems, as we've seen the last several weeks in this series. And yet, somehow, God's will is able to be manifest. And this is more of a miracle than changing water into wine. Leah. Leah, the tender, in my interpretation, the tender but unloved wife, the wife who yearned for her husband's respect and love. Now, through Leah, history was blessed. Jacob probably never would have guessed it. The majority of the leaders of the 12 tribes descended from Leah and her slaves, her handmaiden. When confederated, these 12 tribes will finally result in nationhood. Descendants of Judah, Leah's fourth son, are going to include David and Jesus. Levi, Leah's third son, and Levi's name, it is so bad. His name means, now my husband will love me, for I have borne him three sons. I mean, it's so sad. What a name. However, Levi is actually denied tribal status by his father Jacob, because Jacob is afraid of Levi's uncontrolled anger. Even so, God is able to work in that branch of this dysfunctional family so that Levi's descendants, the Levites, become entrusted with overseeing the worship of Yahweh in the temple. Thus it is that Leah's descendants provide for Israel both its priesthood and its monarchy, the nation's two central pillars. Rachel died in childbirth when delivering Benjamin. The psalm verse that we read for the opening, happy are those who see their children and their children's children. That's something that was denied Rachel. She was buried en route to Bethlehem, but Leah was buried in a cave beside her husband Jacob. Psalm 128, which you have on your sheets, is now something that we can hear in a different way. With this emphasis that we've had on the family, the importance of family, the utter importance of children, of the women producing sons for Jacob in that society, it's a song of ascents, meaning that it's the kind of psalm you would sing just before going to Jerusalem or while you are on your way as a pilgrim to Jerusalem. Happy is everyone who fears the Lord, who walks in his ways. You shall eat the fruit of the labor of your hands. Well, Jacob certainly had to labor 14 years. You shall be happy, and it shall go well with you. Your wife will be like the fruitful vine within your house. Your children will be like olive shoots around the table. Thus shall a man be blessed who fears the Lord. The Lord bless you from Zion. May you see the prosperity of Jerusalem all the days of your life. May you see your children's children. Peace be upon Israel. Verse 6, may you see your children's children. This is something I'll probably never see. It's looking increasingly that way. And I have, I would say, about half of my closest friends either have no children or no grandchildren, and probably none in sight. And it's wonderful that society is such that we no longer depend on children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren for economic security and prosperity in that sense, and that life can be fulfilling nevertheless. But what I like about Point Grey is that together we can watch some of the grandparents here who have grandchildren here relate and interrelate with them, and we can rejoice with them in that, or when their grandchildren come back to visit. And that is wonderful. And they also relate to those of us who have no grandchildren. The other passages that we had, well, Kings, I'll just dismiss it very quickly, but point out that Solomon got more than he asked for, as did Jacob. Solomon asked for the right thing and was given more beside. And although he is going to misuse it later on, God is a very discerning giver, as he was, I think, to the life of Jacob. In Matthew, we have the two very brief parables in a series of what I consider highly exaggerated parables. I mean, really, who's going to sell everything you have to buy a pearl? But it makes a point. And that's, I think, the point of these, what I call, exaggerated parables. The parable of the mustard seed suggests that Jesus was a carpenter and teacher and not a gardener. I can't find any commentary that says the mustard bush is big enough to house bird nests. But that's not the point. The point is, from something very, very small can come something much larger and more important and fruitful. And the same can be said of the parable of the yeast. The writers that I read on that said, well, they're talking, Jesus is talking about enough flour to make lots of bread for 100 people. It's really exaggerated. And we have enough bread in the kitchen for 100 people, and I hope you help yourselves. And the point, again, is that we have some yeast which can go through the flour and transform it. And we've seen a number of kinds of yeast at work in these stories of the life of Jacob. We've seen the yeast of deceit going through the family system, influencing the family, coming close to ruining the family. But the reason we have the stories at all is because there's also the yeast of faith. That yeast has not been emphasized in some of these stories, But it clearly comes through then as we go to the subsequent books in the Bible. The yeast of faith that starts in this family clan is going to have to change. The faith is going to develop. It's going to, just like their concept of marriage, is going to change. Maybe the idea of deceiving, maybe that was considered more cleverness and cunning than it was deceitfulness. Morals are going to evolve as the Bible unfolds, as history unfolds. But in there is that leaven of faith. And that has benefited each of us directly.